the other, the environment, the pollution is important to you. What are the other things that you think?
Well, I think that the things that our ancestors, the way they lived, it's important. You know, like the values that we had. One of the things I hope they never lose is their sharing, their ability to share. Because at one time, Native people lived in a completely communal society where everything was shared, everybody was equal.
Yes.
And sometimes I think that they're losing that with the TVs and children watch so much that they're not ready to share. They become very selfish people, like a lot of other people.
Mm-hmm.
But we have a man, Ralph Schmidt, and he's an addiction counselor at Cape Croker. And he told me that he only has a little Volkswagen car, I think he said, and he couldn't afford snow tires. So he said three times last winter he got off the road, twice on the reserve. And he said, when I got off on the road on the reserve, right away there were people there that helped me put it back. But he says, when I got off the road in the White Settlement, nobody came to help me, which was kind of good to hear, that our people are still willing to give a hand.
Yes.
You know, when as I grew up, we had bees, what we called a bee. We had a bee. We'd bring all our poles down, and then there was a man there that had a buzz saw and could buzz up cords of wood, maybe 25 cords in a day. And so we'd have a bee, and all the men would come. And then we fed them. We'd put on like a feast. And then we'd have like a euchre party or crokinoe or something at night, or a dance as a reward. But everybody had a bee. And this is how they got them things done, was a bee. And I thought, when I came back to Cape Croker, after being away almost 20 years, why can't people help one another anymore? So the first winter I was there, I had a wood bee. And people came all the way from Toronto to that wood bee. And I had enough wood cut that lasted me through the winter in one day. It was cut and brought down. There were trucks and people with tractors and wagons, and I have my own tractor and wagon. And we had that wood all at the house in one day. But nobody else bothers to have those things. And then last summer, the front step of my house was made from cement, and I guess it wasn't a very good batch of cement, and it was crumbling, and twice I fell down it.
Oh dear.
And so I decided I couldn't wait another year. So I had a bee. And enough people came that they tore down that cement old veranda, and I put up a deck almost across the full length of the house in front. And I had enough, they did enough in one day to take that down, and they really worked hard on it to take that down. And I had the floor in and the poofs up, but I didn't have the roof of the deck on yet. It was, but the people came, the men came, of course I fed them good, but I was very pleased.
So you find that after having, well, because you went home every summer, you say.
Yes, I went, and I always have a garden. I did things that, I don't know, I don't want to sound conceited, but I'm the only one on Cape Croker that has ever planted asparagus.
Mm.
And at the old homestead, I don't live there anymore, but it must be when I first got married, and I got married when I was 17, not quite 18, I planted asparagus. They're still using it today.
Is that right?
Because it seeds itself.
That's right. It spreads.
And last summer, well, 2 years ago, I bought some roots and planted it near the house where I now live. I'll be able to start using it this year. But I also brought in rhubarb and planted it, and I had enough rhubarb last year to freeze. Mm-hmm. Now, why don't other people do these things?
Now, when you were a child growing up, was there a vegetable garden like that?
Everybody had a garden. But they never planted, a few people had a rhubarb, but nobody ever planted asparagus.
Mm-hmm. What other kinds of things do you grow in your garden? I'm a gardener and love herbs and whatnot as well. So.
I plant potatoes and Indian corn and sweet corn and squash and carrots, zucchini, onions. I plant a lot of things. Mm-hmm. And last year when I planted my radishes, I planted asparagus with it. And it's slow to germinate, asparagus seed. Uh-huh. And so by the time I used all my radishes, my asparagus was up. Now this year I'll have to transplant it. Mm-hmm. But I'll have enough asparagus roots, I think, to plant an acre of asparagus. So I'll be giving it away and starting other people into asparagus.
When you think of how expensive it is to buy in the
store. Oh, it's terrible.
Oh. And do you still go out and gather wild plants?
Well, I eat dandelions, dock, plantain, all those things. Milkweed. Uh-huh. I eat all those things every year. I eat wild things until my garden's ready to eat. And maybe that's one of the reasons why I was healthy.
I think so. I think the food is so important.
You are what you eat.
Yes, I agree.
And I never was one to use what they call junk food.
Yeah.
And I don't like to see children on junk food.
See,
because I think that if we start them up right. Now, the little girl that I had till she was 12 and a half, she likes vegetables better than she likes meat. If she's going to leave anything on her plate, it'll be meat.
Yeah. And that's usually the thing you have to fight with the children.
Yes.
Well, I've taught in London here for 15 years and taught most of my teaching years in the part of the city where most of the native people come when they're coming in off of the reserves. And one of the things that happened for a lot of them when they first came in was that a lot of foods, the junk foods that were available to them just around the corner from their house would be what they would go for.
I know.
Because they didn't have as much of the other food available. They'd have to go to the stores to buy
what
they had before.
My present husband, his first family, he said, live on junk food. They never cook a big meal. They'll run around the corner and buy some potato chips. And he thinks that's terrible. He's a diabetic, very bad diabetic. He also has pernicious anemia.
Oh, my.
And they've operated on one eye, and he has a contact lens there. And he has to go very shortly to have the other eye. He's deaf. He's almost blind. And I am 78, and he was 65 in December. And yet he's not as well as I am. He needs somebody to look after him.
Yeah.
But he was an addiction counselor in Toronto at the Friendship Center for almost 20 years.
Mm.
He's a member of AA for 20 years, which was something that I ran to in my first marriage, was the alcohol thing.
Mm.
Which is pretty awful, I tell you.
I know.
Yeah, it's a very hard thing to live with.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I feel so bad for our people, our young people that are getting into it. They all go through that stage of teenagers, some earlier, some later, before they start to settle down. But I have one grandson that has never got into alcohol or drugs yet, and he's 19 now.
Oh, he may
He's an example to them. What he does when his buddies, you know, his school friends and things like that, start to drink on a weekend and are driving, he goes and takes the keys from them and he drives them around. Mm-hmm. But he never takes a drink. But he doesn't want them to be picked up.
Yeah. Or hurt.
That's right.
When they're driving. Yeah, I have my daughter is 17, and it's the kind of thing that you sit and you worry and you wonder. I'm not so much worried about her drinking, but I'm worried about will she be in a car with somebody who is drinking. But fortunately, she's called me a couple of times and said, come and get me.
Yeah.
She said, I can't get home with these people, so you worry so much.
Yes, my granddaughter is the same way. Yeah. If her children call her, she goes right away and picks them up.
It's good that the kids do that.
Well, that they're willing to.
That's right.
Because for some of them, their pride won't let them.
That's right.
Go to their parents. But I have a lot of my grandchildren come and talk to me.
When
they won't talk to their mother as much as they will talk to me.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a lot of contact with them.
They are so lucky. I think I have two daughters, and I think we are very far away from both of the grandmothers, and so that it's just when we go to visit, a few times a year, what they've missed because they only have me, and
yes.
I'm not so patient with them.
Well, also
as a grandmother would be,
and also you're busy.
Yeah.
This is what I always defend women of today, because they put their children in daycare. Because you cannot live in a city under one what your husband makes.
That's right.
So they have to go to work. They don't have any choice if they want to have any kind of a living.
That's right.
I know I raised my children through the Depression. And I made their clothes from rummage, church rummages and all that. And a lot of times they were better dressed than the other children. Mm-hmm. Because I could never have afforded to buy the materials that was in that rummage. So I'd bring it home and rip it up and wash it and press it and make their clothes. I even made the boys' briefs and the girls' overcoats through the Depression days. And I sewed, I think, for everybody on Cape Croker during that time. And I never got money. I'd get a pound of butter, a dozen eggs, bag of beans, anything like that. But I dress made, I think, for everybody on the Cape. And my daughter now is a very good dressmaker. She has made her own coats because I did it. And this winter I made a lot of quilt tops. And my younger daughter, she lives in Niagara Falls, New York. And all her life she's asked me to make her a quilt. So I decided that I better do it this year. And I belong to the seniors. I'm vice president of the seniors up there. And so to get them so that they would be occupied and not just sit and watch TV,
mm-hmm.
I took that heritage pattern, crown of thorns.
Mm-hmm.
I took them the material and I said, now each of you make two blocks. And I gave it out. And I said, when we get enough blocks, we'll make a quilt and then we'll sell tickets on it. And maybe next year we can go on bus trips. We can hire a bus. I only got blocks back from one person. She gave me two blocks back. And she says, I had a headache because there's 36 pieces in that one block. She says, it gave me a headache. But I never got any back from anybody else. So I finished it. That crown of thorns. I've quilted it now, and I'm ready to take it to my daughter for her birthday. Oh, she'll be thrilled. It's a beautiful thing. Just beautiful.
My mother is a quilter, and I'm familiar with that pattern.
Yeah.
What colors did you use in it?
It's mauve and gold, a lot of it, and black.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a beautiful quilt. And it's big.
I used 35 blocks in it.
And then I made another one. I have a granddaughter in Toronto, and she lives right downtown, so anytime we go to Toronto, we just go there. My husband and I both have a key to her house, and we just go in and make ourselves at home. So I took her a quilt. When she saw it, she says, I don't think I'll ever use it. I'll hang it on the wall.
Oh.
It also is a big quilt. And then with all the leftovers, I made another quilt for myself, and I'm going to make another quilt that'll be red, white, and blue. And I'm going to sell tickets on for the powwow.
That's wonderful.
But I have enough patches to make about two or three more tops. It takes me 3 days to quilt, after it's set up and everything, to quilt a quilt.
And that has to be 3 days of constant work.
Yeah, of constant sewing.
Yes.
Early in the morning till late at night.
Mm. I admire you. You come from parents who were both Native How do you see that that might make your experience different than maybe some others on your reserve? What did you get from each of those backgrounds?
Well, I don't know what I got, but when I got into trouble in my Native values, I'd turn white and pick up my white values. But then when I got in trouble in my white values, I'd go back to Indian. I didn't realize this until I read my own life story.
Mm-hmm.
But my Indian was always more important to me than the other, because I always went back to it.
And did you ever, was there times when you didn't get the support you might have wanted from Native people,
I was growing up, when I was young. It was a good thing we were a large family, because at that time, practically all the children spoke Indian. Mm-hmm. And they used to call me Anishinaabekweth and other names, which meant a dirty little white girl, and things like that. They were very discriminatory. But there were enough of us. My mother and her sister were the first two white women to marry into that reserve.
Mm-hmm.
And my aunt had 10 children, and my mother altogether had 14. And so there were enough of us that we banded together and could handle anything that came up at school.
Yeah. Do you ever run into anything now on the reserve, any of the bad feeling that you remember from when you were
not
a child?
Not for me, not for me. And at one time in my life, I had already come to Toronto and started that boarding house for Native students. And we had what they called a development officer. And I had a heart failure here, and I was in the hospital. And he came to see me, and he begged me to go back to Cape Croker. And I said, why? He says, because you're so needed there. He said, I went around to every house on Cape Croker and talked to the people. And he said, you're the one person that I never heard anything said against. If they didn't have anything good, they didn't talk about you at all. And I remember when at one time there was a woman from Cape Croker that had lived off. She was an Indian woman, and she came back. She was very poor. And so she belonged to the United Church, so the United Church went around and gathered food for her. And I can remember they came to me, and I gave her two or three pounds of margarine and stuff that I had in the house. And I found out afterward that I was the only Catholic home that they went to. Now that meant something.
Sure does.
Yeah, I was the only Catholic home that they went to. And I don't know if it's in there. I don't think it's in that biography about when I took over the hockey club.
No, uh-uh.
Well, they asked me. Some of the boys that played hockey came and asked me if I would manage the hockey club. They asked me to come to a meeting, and I went to the meeting, and I didn't know what they wanted from me. So they asked me if I'd take over the club. And I said, why do you want me to take over the club? I said, I never skated or played hockey. And they said, but you're a good manager. And they said, we're so in debt that we can't even get sticks in Wyarton to play with. So I said, well, give me a week to think about it. I thought, well, this is something I don't know anything about. And I thought about it for about a week, and then I went back to them. And I said, okay, I'll take this over under one condition, and I'm going to tell you that if I ever go to a game in Wyarton and see any of you come on the ice under the influence, I've resigned. And so I took them over. I got them out of debt. And certainly I know some of them drank, but the other boys would hide them so I wouldn't see them. And you know, the 2 years that I managed them, they won the Bush League Club and they won the All-Indian Tournament Cup. We got out of debt. I got them out of debt. They had money in the bank. I bought them new outfits. And when they won the All-Indian Championship, I bought them jackets. In 2 years. But I had the cooperation of the whole reserve for that. When they went and played in Wyarton, all the games were played in Wyarton. When the games were over, I had a barrack box. They put all their things and they dropped them in front of my house. Mm-hmm. I'd bring them in. If there was a hole in any of the socks, I mended it. They never once, while I was manager, went on the ice with a hole in their socks or any part of their uniforms. And so the people were proud of them. But I did that for 2 years. I also did a lot with the youngsters on the reserve, because at that time there was no provision for recreation, no money to buy balls and bats and backstops. Mm-hmm. And so I trained two different ages of children on the reserve, and I put on concerts with those little children. And we were able to buy balls and bats and backstops and all these things for the summer holidays when they would play.
Oh, that's great.
But that's one of the things I did. And they were so good that sometimes I was asked out to Wyarton, Culpoys, Lion's Head, to go and put that concert on. I learned how to call off, and I bought the reels, and I trained the children to do the quadrille. And then they were so cute, you know, the little ones could step dance. But when we started, we had more fun with them, because when the little boys would swing, they'd throw the little girls on the floor. It was really something to see. But by the time they come on stage, they were letter perfect. They could go through that, and I called off for them. Oh, I think I had a great life.
I'm just, from what I've read and from what I've heard tonight, it's clear that you have so much richness in your life.
I've had. Without setting out to do anything, I've been able to have so many things that I can think about and enjoy. A lot of memories I got. I'm rich, very rich with memories. When I was in Toronto and worked with the Native people there, George Kenney did a sonnet on me. I've been honored 3 times. I was honored when I became Native Woman of the Year. I was honored in Toronto at Endion. Long after I quit working there, they honored me. And I was honored when they had their centennial. I was the keynote speaker there for the centennial. So I have had a lot of recognition from my own people in the city. Mm-hmm. And also on the reserve now, I notice that I'm getting recognition. Because when they have Heritage Day, there's usually something up in the hall written about me. Mm-hmm. Maybe my books and the children hearing me on Sesame Street and being able to go to the school